Thank you. And the plan for today is just to tell you a little bit about what I've been up to in this past 1, 2 years. My main point of interest is the neutrino sector. And just a reminder for everybody, if you've forgotten this, I doubt you will, but we know that neutrinos have masses and mix. And a very interesting point about neutrino masses is that they're much, much smaller than any other standard model fermion mass. So this is a value that we don't know precisely what it is, but we can estimate that at least two neutrinos would have a mass of order 0.05 eV. This is 7 orders of magnitude below the electron mass. Another interesting point is the fact that the mixing in the neutrino sector is very different from the mixing in the quark sector. And that begs the question whether neutrinos carry the same mass mechanism as the other standard model fermions. So if you ask the question, do neutrinos get a mass from the Higgs? If yes, then we need the presence of an additional right-handed neutrino field, which is a very harmless addition to the standard model, perfectly fine theory. I add this new complete singlet under all gauge symmetries. But upon doing that, I also have to ask the question, does this state admit a minor on the mass term? In general, that will be true. This mass term will violate Lepton number by 2 units. So one can also ask the question, is Lepton number conserved or not? This is the same question in a way as to whether neutrinos are Dirac or Majorana particles. Now, this is a pretty unique question that you can ask only in the neutrino sector, which I think makes this a worthwhile set of particles to study. Now, the questions that experimentalists ask in the neutrino sector are much more basic than that one. They're basically all related to, do we know the PM&S matrix well? The first question you could ask is there a CP violating phase? So we know we have three neutrinos. So in general, at least one CP violating phase will show up. This one phase will appear in oscillations whenever you have the two mass differences at play at the same time, which we have never seen so far. That's for the future program of neutrino experiments. We also don't know the ordering of the neutrinos. Is the third or the second the heaviest of them? We know the answer to that question between the second and the first neutrino because we've seen oscillations or flavor transitions in solar neutrinos, but we have never seen to great precision matter effects in the two and three sector. So this still remains an open question, but not for long. And the final one is just a more general remark in the sense that can we over-constrain the PM&S matrix like we did in the quark sector? And that includes things like testing for the unitarity of the matrix and consistency between different measurements of the same parameters. So we're lucky to have a very large experimental program to answer these questions. I'm showing here just a compilation of results. Most of these are accelerator type of experiments, whether it be atmospheric accelerators or man-made accelerators. But there's a plethora of other which will either try to answer similar questions to these ones or other questions like are neutrinos Dirac or Majorana or using neutrinos as tools, for example, to learn about nuclear physics or astrophysics. But this talk is using this program to ask a slightly different question, which is whether or not we can find a new type of new physics in the neutrino sector with the same program. It would be great if we could, and especially it would be great if we found this new physics and it told us something interesting about this initial, more fundamental questions. So that's the kind of idea just to set the context for the talk. So here's the outline. I'm going to tell you a little bit about CESO models, especially lamp post ones, once we can actually test in the laboratory and dress up these models in secret interactions and see what happens. And I will discuss the phenomenological searches for these particles. And then at the end, if we have time, we can explore some applications, like, for example, the Minibund anomaly and a possible explanation of the G-2 with these dark photons. So this is work done in a collaboration with lots of people here from Durham University, Bologna, Columbia, and Harvard. these people here are experimentalists, and this up here are my theorist friends. So you can see a couple of papers here that we've written, but some work in this talk will also be in progress. So yes, please ask me questions and interrupt me anytime you want to. Okay, so let me start very basic. Just a refresher of the type one seesaw, probably one of the more elegant ways to explain neutrino masses as an extension of the standard model. I will call my right-handed neutrino N. So now this will be a separate Majorana mass eigenstate because of its Majorana mass MN, which I'm allowed to write even though it violates Lepton number. After electric symmetry breaking, I have the neutrino mass matrix here as a matrix of submatrices. And if you consider these entries like numbers, we have the naive scaling, as we've all seen, of the neutrino masses being suppressed by the square of the Yukawas times the ratio of electric scale over this new scale, which in principle may know nothing about the electric scale. It could be below it or above it, depending on my choice of parameters. So the story usually goes that neutrino masses will be small, either because I have very small Yukawas with relatively light heavy neutrinos, or I may have Yukawas that are large, but very large values for MN, which are very much beyond reach of experimental program. But in reality, a point I want to emphasize is that neutrino masses don't come from this naive scaling. They come from a matrix multiplication. This may sound trivial, but at the end of the day, the left-hand side of the neutrino mass matrix is a 3x3 matrix. But the right-hand side, even though we know the external dimensions of this multiplication, we don't know anything in principle about the inside dimensions of this matrix MN. This is very interesting because all of the new physics and the interesting beyond the standard model statements will live inside of this matrix here. And that's where new symmetries or new cancellations or even new dynamics may be hiding. And this is the idea we'll pursue here. As a very simple example, if you consider the standard model to have a single generator of light neutrinos, new left in this case, I can write down a Majorana mass matrix, which has two generations. So I'll have a family of leptons N, which are my right-handed neutrinos, and a family of leptons S with an opposite lepton number to those Ns. This very simple extension for the Majorana mass matrix, now I have two families of new heavy fermions for every family of light neutrinos. And what you see is that in this 3x3 simple scenario, there are actually three lepton number violating parameters in the mass matrix in all generality. You can convince yourself that that's true under all assignments of lepton number. Upon diagonalizing this mass matrix, you see that all light neutrino masses will be proportional to these lepton number violating parameters, and therefore they are protected by lepton number, as you would expect. And you may end up in a scenario where even though you could have large values for m squared, which is my Dirac mass, and reasonably small values of lambda within experimental reach, I can still get small neutrino masses by sending this lepton number violating parameters to be very, very small. So in the limit of exact lepton number conservation, neutrino masses are zero. So you could softly break that a little bit by this lepton number violating parameters. Oh, and my laptop is dying, but...
While it dies, can I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's so just to make sure I have the right sense of the scale. So you're never going to be, you're always in the limit where your sterile sector is heavy, right? In the sense that in your previous slide, when you wrote this formula of a matrix times an inverse matrix times a matrix, that was valid in the approximation that the inverse matrix, it was the first term in the expansion and in the inverse powers of that heavy matrix, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I'm always working in the so-called seesaw limit where the parameters in MN are typically heavier compared to the Dirac mass time.
Yeah, I see. Okay, good. Mm-hmm. So in this example you've got here, you can't make lambda arbitrarily small compared to little m, for
correct.
Example.
Yes, correct.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
So you could work in the limit where md gives you cows of order of the electron, and that will be, from a point of view, if you're looking for larger couplings, more elegant than if they were at the level of 10 to minus 12, for example.
Sure, okay, thank you.
For some reason, the plugs in my office are not working. So I'm gonna try and find something else.
It's his first day in the office, so of course he has to.
This is at PI?
Yeah.
Sorry, guys, bear with me.
No problem.
And where are you, Davide?
I'm also in the office, yeah, at Perimeter.
You're also at PI. Yeah. You haven't left.
In 2 weeks, I'm going.
I see. All right. So you've got your housing all set up?
Actually, yeah. I managed to find it because a postdoc there was changing his apartment, so I took his.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Okay, so there we go. I had to try the third outlet. This one worked.
Good.
Okay, thanks. Cool. So, yeah. So we discussed the lepton number violating case. This is a very trivial extension of the simple naive scaling in the seesaw formula. And it gives you an alternate reason to set the neutrino masses to be small. So it's an alternate explanation for light neutrino masses. I want to explore these matrices in two different regimes. This will be useful for later on in the talk. And I think it's also interesting to see how two very naively similar scenarios can give you very different answers by choosing the correct texture for these mass matrices. So on the left, I have the classical inverse seesaw. I think probably have all seen this mass matrix before. And that gives me exactly what you expect. At tree level, light neutrino masses are proportional to mu, which is a violating lepton number, and are suppressed by the ratio of these scales, MD over lambda. On the right, however, all I've done is really give a Majorana mass for N, but not for the state S. And what you see is that provided the number of states N is the same as the number of states S, at the end of the day, your tree level mass for light neutrinos will vanish. And that's just the cancellation. There's no reason why you would hold at several orders in the gauge couplings. So at loop level, you generate this since it's not protected by anything in particular, except lepton number, but we're violating that through mu prime. We can understand this by working in the opposite limit. Instead of setting the lepton number parameters to be very small, let's set them to be very large. So on the left-hand side, I'm integrating out S, and on the right-hand side, I'm integrating out N. And what you see is that in the inverse seesaw, by having very large lepton number violation, I'm seesawing the state N, which in turn, given that this parameter will be larger than MD, will seesaw the light neutrinos, giving you this correct formula here for the neutrino masses. On the right, something different happens where when I integrate N out, it will seesaw both the light neutrinos as well as the state S, and it'll give you democratic mixing between the two. And at the end of the day, you end up with a cancellation in the light neutrino masses. You can convince yourself of that by just computing the determinant of this matrix and seeing that it is rank one. So in these two cases, we have very similar mass matrices, but at the end of the day, your dependence on the new physics couplings will be very different. In fact, on the right-hand side here, I also get a dependence on the gauge couplings, still at the end of the day, depending on the mu prime parameter. Okay, so these models are telling you that you could have neutrino mass models at the lower scales, either because of small Yukawa couplings or also because of these cancellations that you could have in the limit of approximate lepton number conservation. So any questions so far before I move to the FINA?
Sorry, that M was the what you were calling MD. Is the UCAVA times the
MD? Yes. Sorry, this should read MD in the.
Yeah. Sorry, just to thanks.
Yeah. Good catch. Okay. So then you can ask, have we seen these states, and how well constrained is this possibility? And to understand that, I'll tell you a little bit about the phenomenology from the MEV to the GEV scale, which is, as we'll see, the lamppost for these new physics searches. So whenever you have this light neutrinos, they, in the minimal scenario, can only really interact via the weak force, further suppressed by their small mixing with active neutrinos. So if you want, their interactions are weaker than weak in that sense, that they're always proportional to the G Fermi, further suppressed by mu. And if you compare the lifetime of these states, they will be related to the muon lifetimes approximately by this relation here. So,
Mateus, can I ask something? So what's the mode? I'm not that familiar with all the different types of CISOs, but what's the motivation behind this? I mean, for the normal CISO, the right-hand neutrino is usually heavy unless you make the UCAVA small. And the motivation for this then is that since you're putting these soft parameters to be zero, then small, then these states are light, and then you can look for them?
Correct. Yeah,
that's correct. But in the normal CISO, you could also make the UCAVA small and make the heavy neutrinos light, and then,
True, yeah. Both of these possibilities, in my opinion, actually, as you know, as appealing as the other, the minimal CISO is minimal. You just have to live with the fact that your UCAVAs are very, very small. You're mixing to get the correct neutrino masses and mixing, and then they will also be small at the lowest scales. But it scales actually favorably. So the mixing actually goes up as you go to lighter and lighter heavy neutrino masses in the minimal model. In these low-scale CISO models, what happens is that the parameters that control neutrino masses, which are these lepton number parameters, lepton number violating parameters, they may not be necessarily related to your neutrino mixing parameters. So I may have a situation where light stereoneutrinos can have large mixings, but still give you the correct neutrino masses, which is actually very tricky to do in the minimal CISO. In fact, the only way to do that in the minimal CISO is to appeal to cancellations, which at the end of the day look like a lepton number conservation limit.
I see. Okay, so you want to make these angles large.
Yeah.
Okay.
So from a phenomenological point of view, all that you really care about is the mass of these states and their mixing with active neutrinos. The relation to the underlying theory will depend whether you have, you know, three heavy neutrinos for three generations of neutrinos, or you have six generations, two for each light neutrino, for example, like in this low scale realizations.
Or maybe not even one for each generation or two for each generation, right?
Yeah.
So it sounds like from the point of view of the effective theory, it's just really a question of whether you have light states in addition to the usual three. And when you do the phenomenology, what are you aiming at? Are these states are going to be kind of at the weak scale, or are they going to be, you know, lower than that, or where was?
So yeah, as we'll see, I want them to be at the MEV to GEV scale because that's where our probing power is greatest. So right. I'll get into that just now, and next slide. So yeah, this is the so once we admit that okay, HNLs may be light if they are in the MEV to GEV scale, they will behave very similar to a muon in terms of its decays, except will be much more longer lived because of the small mixing angle. So in terms of these parameters, let's say we're mixing with the electron flavor versus the mass of the heavy neutrino here. This is a purely phenomenological plot. So the mixing here is not being related to the mass parameter. You could do that by picking a specific complete underlying theory, but we'll just look at the phenomenological point of view for now. As you can see, if I am around the kaon mass, that's where our strongest bounds lie. And you also see, maybe it's a little bit difficult to see in this plot, there's a constraint from BBN running up this value here, where below this line, you're excluding these states simply because they will be thermal in the early universe, and if they survive to BBN epoch, they will change your element abundances. So cosmology is telling you that the lifetime of these states cannot be too long. And from the laboratory point of view, you're constraining the mixing to be not too large. So they are complementary to each other, and they really close in this region below the Keon mass. So that's where the lamppost is. That's where most stringent constraints come from. And there are two types of constraint in this region. As usual, if you have these states weakly interacting, you produce them in meson decays. The branching ratio is really only controlled by this mixing angle. So this behaves just like a neutrino from all points of view, except it gets produced a fraction U alpha squared of the time. So you could produce them in pion and kaon decays and look for missing mass in this system. If you know the pion and the lepton momentum, you'd be able to tell whether there was some missing mass in the system. So that's, for example, this constraint from NA62. And you could also produce them in pion and meson decays in general, let them propagate for a distance since they're long-lived, and try to catch their visible decays further down your experiment. So you could have a detector further away from the production source. So most of the searches in this parameter space will be looking for things that are invisible or long-lived. And as I said, we have a bound from below, on the lifetime from cosmology. But in general, in all generality, there is no really lower bound on the lifetime of these states. And that's what we want to explore here, is the possibility that in the model where we have here, just mixing versus mass, I cannot go to mixing of order one to make this guy have the lifetime of the muon, but I can add new interactions in this heavy neutrino sector and decouple the lifetime from these parameters of the phenomenological model. So,
do you assume anything about lepton number being violated, or is it?
For this discussion so far, no. But later on, I'll introduce a model, a particular model, and then I'll tell you what parameters are lepton number violating. But I won't actually take any limit. You could, if you wanted, take a limit where they would be small. But I would just remain completely agnostic about them, just for the sake of the philological discussion.
The reason I ask is that I remember back in the day, there was the discussion about things like neutrinoless double beta decay become much more sensitive to the sweet spot for getting a big signal. It would be to have masses of the sterile neutrinos kind of in the 100 MeV ballpark, which is right in your window there. And are those bounds one of the curves that are on that plot? I can't really read it very well.
This plot doesn't show those bounds, but they would actually be the strongest bounds in this mixing hierarchy. So you're mixing with electron flavor. So if these states are 100 MeV to 1 MeV, that is the leading constraint coming from the neutrinoless double beta decay. Just because but that is in the case where your Majorana mass is large. If I assume a lepton number conserving limit, like in this low scale seesaws, those constraints disappear.
Right. Yeah. That's kind of what I'm asking. So it sounds like so the prejudice you should have when you come in here is that to use these bounds, you're really supposing that that whatever is producing these masses is dominantly is suppressing the lepton number violating part of this of the
correct.
Whatever's
yes
okay.
Correct.
Okay. Okay.
So the bounds you see in this plot here are very generic bounds. They're not all model independent, except maybe these pion and kaon ones, but the ones from double beta decay, there will be model dependent in the sense of what you just said. If I have lepton number conserving, they do not apply.
Why the electroweak precision bounds are flat? They don't seem to depend on mass.
At some point you just integrate these states out and they basically give you things like non-unitarity. And in this case, actually, if I only mix with a single flavor, what you get is also lepton non-universality, because these things may be produced in muon channels, but not electron channels, for example.
Oh, no, I see what's going on. You're holding the mixing angle fixed and you're making this guy heavy, So, but the observable only depends on the mixing angle. So essentially you're cranking up the couplings to hold the mixing angle fixed.
I could work in a scenario where it's democratic across all flavors. And then what happens in that case is I don't get left on the universality constraints. But if any of the two, you know, mixing angles have a hierarchy between electron and muon, for example, then I get constraints from lepton universality, for example.
But those electroweak precision bounds are from lepton universality?
Good question.
Probably not.
I actually think that they are. So if you look at this plot here, you see that the strongest constraints here are coming from lepton universality. I don't remember if there's anything else going into these ones. All that I could really think about would be Z decays.
Yeah, it's just a Z decay to electrons.
Right. And that case is a non-unitarity kind of statement, because you produce, you know, three families instead of four. So you have a one minus mixing angle squared. And that's it that I can remember. But yeah, maybe there's something additional here. We can take a look. So yeah, the point I wanted to make is in a agnostic scenario where we remain agnostic about the probabilities of the decay of the H and L's, lots of these constraints disappear because they rely on a fixed relationship between production and lifetime. But if I decouple those relations, only a few ones survives, especially those that are based on unitarity, lepton universality, and these missing mass searches, which if I have a properly decaying heavy neutrino that would appear in these detectors also get relaxed somewhat, because if you're looking for missing mass, you'd like to veto these additional particles. So you'd veto a fraction of your events, but it's not a major effect. So that's why I just shade a little bit in yellow this region around the peak searches. So what I'm going to do is use the neutrino portal to some dark sector where these heavy neutrinos will acquire Majorana masses and talk to other particles, which may be subject to new fundamental symmetries and also may come with additional scalars, for example, to break those symmetries. And if that's the case, then we may produce these particles via the neutrino portal, and we can ask the question, can they leak back to the standard model via one of the other portals, for example, kinetic mixing or scalar mixing. So we'll try and remain generic in this portal framework. And one can build a very simple model for that. This is what we did recently. It's a very simple model to kind of use only the portal couplings between a dark sector and the standard model to make these heavy neutrinos decay faster. So we have a completely sterile state that will be responsible for mixing. So here's my Yukawa coupling, my neutrino portal. And we have a vector-like fermion charged under a new gauge symmetry, a U1. This is anomaly free, and it's also this U1 will be broken by the VEV of this new scalar, which I'll choose to be in the GV range. So what happens in this case is I'm free to write down a Majorana mass term for N, which you could think comes from a separate kind of new physics. One can give a dynamical meaning to this MN parameter. I won't ask too many questions about that, but I can also write down a Dirac mass term for these for this vector-like fermion. This won't be lepton number violating, but it's also a free parameter of the theory that could come, for example, from another dynamical sector. And my completely sterile neutrino is also mixing with these dark neutrinos through this new scalar phi. So all the couplings of the dark sector to the standard model proceed through portals. Now, in terms of neutrino masses, what this model will do is give you a combination of those two seesaw, low scale seesaws that I showed before. One where we saw the minimal radiative inverse seesaw, and another which comes from the inverse seesaw, the classical contribution. So as you diagonalize this mass matrix and go to one loop order, what you see is there's a tree level contribution coming from MX, which is in principle arbitrary for me, And there will be also contribution at the one loop level, which will depend on MN. And in fact, now I get contributions, not just from the standard model, but also from my dark sector bosons at loop level. So this will depend on standard model gauge couplings, as well as this new U1X gauge couplings. And finally, the FINO, which is what really motivated us to write down this thing, is to make this the case of the heavy neutrinos faster. So in the mass basis, all my heavy neutrinos, I'll call them Ni. So I running from 4 to number of generations. And all of these in all generality will talk to the new force, which I will call dark photon Z prime. These decays can go back to the standard model via kinetic mixing of the Z prime with the hypercharge. And they will typically dominate due to the lightness of the Z prime compared to the weak bosons over the weak contributions. In particular, if I have decays within the dark sector in the neutral leg, so N5 going to N4, this is not necessarily proportional to the small neutrino mixing angles. It will be proportional to mixing angles in the dark sector. So this could be completely unsuppressed by the light neutrino mixing, the heavy light neutrino mixing. Another point to make here is that if this is happening to the heavy neutrinos, you don't necessarily have charge current branching ratios. That's an important observation because those are really our only chance to observe lepton number violating from the decays of these heavy neutrinos. For instance, if I produce them in the decays of kaons to mu plus n, one interesting search you could do is n undergoes charge current decay in a lepton number violating way to mu plus pi minus, and that would be a clear sign of lepton number violation. But unfortunately, in this model, this disappears completely simply because this rate is buried under a much larger new physics contribution, which will be accompanied by missing energy, so you won't be able to tell the overall lepton number of the final state. So these are the three phenological points of the model. And you could ask what happens depending on the parameters of on the strength of my new force. If I'm close to the weak strength, so my new, could think of a new G Fermi in the dark sector. If it is similar to G Fermi from the weak sector, we simply get a very similar phenomenology with additional branching ratios. But as I increase the strength, I get shorter-lived particles, so more decays in flight, until the point where they start decaying too short, too fast in comparison to your source detector baseline. And then they may be produced in scattering. So for example, neutrinos can upscatter into this new heavy neutrino N through the new force. And finally, if it is very prompt, I can also look at prompt meson decays where I produce N, and instead of looking at missing energy, I can search for the additional decay products of N. So that's kind of a line in baseline in lifetime. As I go to shorter and shorter lifetimes, my phenomenology changes a lot. So just a briefer on neutrino experiments, which is where I'm going to be interested in looking for these things. We have protons on target producing a series of mesons, pions, and kaons, some muons. These get focused by magnetic horns. So you can see here the neutrino flux from pions and kaons before the effect of the magnetic horns and after the effect of the magnetic horns, which is really focusing these particles towards lower energies and directing them towards your beam. So increasing your overall flux as they decay in the decay volume. They then get stopped at some beam dump, and you are left only with the neutrinos to measure them at a near detector site, hope they oscillate on the way to a far detector site where you measure them again, hopefully in a different flavor. Now, most of these new physics searches are more interesting at the near detector where your neutrino flux is largest, and your PID capabilities may be better because you have a more compact design. This is certainly true for T2K in Japan. And they have an off-axis near detector called ND280. this is a very interesting detector because it's highly segmented. So it starts with layers of very heavy lead material. This sandwiches a water target with also layers of lead and carbon, and is followed by very low density materials like gaseous argon. Layers they hope to observe neutrino scattering with the nuclei, giving you, for example, pi zeros or electrons, which will shower very efficiently inside of this high density region. And in this low density region, they're hoping to detect things like muons and pions that get produced potentially in the interactions in the lead and then get leaked into the low density region. Neutrinos don't like to interact, so your backgrounds will be very small. But the decays of the HNLs don't care about the density, so if they happen in this low density region, you could see them better with higher efficiency and lower backgrounds. And because of a magnetic field in this near detector, if they decay to E plus E minuses, as they often do, you would see the separation of those two particles. Now, we did this for T2K for the minimal and non-minimal versions of heavy neutrino models. So you can see on the left here, the case of mixing with the muon flavor without the addition of any new interaction. You can see the parameter space is very strongly constrained. So you see the cosmology constraints here from BBN, excluding everything below this dashed line. And you see other model independent constraints in gray, and our new constraints in blue and pink. You can see they help improve the complementarity here. And in fact, T2K provides the leading limits in this mass region, which for some reason the literature missed. There was some PS0.1 constraint that people thought was the strongest one. We showed that that was not the case and that T2K is actually better and can continue to improve with the new design that they're currently implementing. But the point here is that if I go from the minimal model to a model where I have new decay rates mediated by this dark sector, which I'm just gonna assume is mediated by this new strength GX here, the cosmology constraints get weakened.
We are not hearing you.
And because my...
Yeah, you went muted for like 20 seconds or so.
Sorry, I think you're cutting out a bit.
Yeah, we don't hear you very well. So maybe you want to repeat your last minute or something.
Oh, I can try switching to K.
Oops. Yeah, I think it's the second time. The first time I saw it was my problem.
Then... You're muted? Yeah, me too. I thought it was my fault.
Yeah.
So, Mateusz, you should unmute yourself.
No, I think we lost him. He's probably reconnecting. So Cliff, where are you now?
I'm at home.
Oh, you haven't?
No, we leave in just rented an apartment. Hopefully today, so we'll be leaving in about a month.
I see.
Leaving for for where, if I can ask?
Oh, to CERN. I'm going to be in CERN from November 1st until next October.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of a risk taking a sabbatical during a pandemic, but not teaching during a pandemic is good.
I think they're resuming activity.
Yes, I think that's right.
Maybe there won't be so many visitors, but
yeah.
Yes, right. That'll be true. Yeah.
Yeah, we can hear you, Mateusz.
You
muted yourself again.
You're muted right now.
So you hear me well, right?
Now, yeah.
Hello.
Hear you, yeah.
Yes.
His picture still has a mute sign on it, but I was hearing him at one point.
Yeah, which is very weird. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, me too. I thought it was maybe some tablet connecting, but
yeah, maybe the internet in his office is not the best or something. I don't know. Would be really bad luck.
Daniel, you're in your office now, I guess. Are you?
Yeah, we are all in the office. Yeah.
So where is his office relative to where you guys are?
It's at the second floor, 260.
Hello, can you hear me better now?
Yes.
Okay, sorry about that. I don't know what's going on. I'm connected to the same internet.
No problem.
Yeah.
It's not your fault.
Sounds like I've never had technical difficulties working from home, but the first time I come to PI, it'll be harder. So. Okay.
Yeah.
And you don't see my screen yet, right?
We see it.
Oh, you do.
Yeah, we do see it.
Yeah, I think you explained the left figure and you are switching to the right figure and then we lost you.
Yeah, so the right figure is the generalization of the left one in the case where you have additional decays into E plus E minus mediated by the dark photon, which I assume to be heavy at the order GeV for this, you know, compared to the low masses of the HNLs here. So for an interaction strength of three orders of magnitude larger than G Fermi, I am starting to probe a new parameter space, which is not probed by cosmology because of the short lifetimes of the HNLs, but it's more efficiently probed by this decay in flight searches, purely because in the long lifetime limit, your event rate is proportional to your overall decay rate. So by increasing the decay rate into the signal mode, I increase my number of events. So that's the first thing you would do to search for these particles. As their decay length becomes shorter, you can do something different. Now your contribution to the interactions of N is sufficiently large that you could also beat weak scattering of neutrinos and start upscattering into these heavy neutrinos N. Now T2K in your detector is particularly suited for that. Like I was telling you, there are very heavy plates of lead here. And through this new interaction, because it adds coherently over the whole nuclei of lead, so it scales like Z squared. So you really gain from a factor of 82 squared. I can produce a lot of heavy neutrinos in this lead, in these dense layers, and hope that they travel sufficiently far, but not too far, to decay inside of the gaseous volume. So that gives you the E plus E minus of the signatures that we were looking before, but now from the upscattering, which is coherent. So you don't see anything in the first vertex, but you do see the E plus E minus from the decay afterwards. The signal, of course, does not look the same as the decaying flight signal. So here you have the E plus E minus energy. You can see the decaying flight signature, the one I discussed in the previous slide. And here you see the upscattering signature, which makes sense. In one case, my HNLs were coming directly from KM decay and decaying. In this case, I'm coming from neutrinos, which upscatter, losing some part of their energy, when then subsequently decay to E plus E minus. But still, even with the lower energies, we get decent levels of signal efficiencies. And you can see we place constraints on mixing versus mass. But of course, those will depend on other dark sector parameters that control the lifetime. The conclusion here is that T2K precludes any signature of upscattering into these particles in any other neutrino experiments, as long as your C tau is greater than order 5 centimeters, which is typically the length between the lead layers and the gaseous argon TPCs. So you need to live below this type of lifetimes in order to get something interesting in other experiments. It's a pretty strong constraint. And finally, the last thing you would do here is produce them in kaon decays and look for the additional E plus E minus. If you do that, you have several handles on the kinematics. The first one is the usual peak search, where you measure the lepton momentum and the kaon momentum very well, and you look for what would be missing mass. In this case, it turns out not to be, because it gives you additional particles. But that constraint is still there. You would also identify the final state, whether it be a neutrino or another HNL, and by the combination of these momenta. So you'd sum all visible momentum in the system, and you should be able to find this one, which is now a truly missing mass. And finally, depending on whether the Z prime is on or off shell, you'd also have a handle on the E plus E minus invariant mass. This rate has been measured in the case of the E plus E minus with alongside a muon, and has been constrained in the case of three muons by previous experiments. The measurement is not great. And both of these channels will actually be revisited and are currently being measured by NA62. The challenge with these channels is that this is a radiative process in the standard model. So if I have low invariant masses for the E plus E minus, I'm competing with this very fastly rising peak at the photon-like region of my signal. That's coming purely from a large rate of pi zero production, which can give you Dalitz decays where you miss the photon and you end up seeing the E plus E minus from the converted photon of pi zero decay, and some other also from pion decays, but this is a less serious background to worry about. Ultimately, none of this will matter if you have displaced vertices, which NA62 corresponds to of order 10 picoseconds for the lifetime of N in the lab frame. If I have an on-shell Z prime, this is the perfect scenario where you would see a bump at the Z prime mass in the E plus E minus system, as well as a bump in the missing mass, which in this case is not missing, for the heavy neutrino mass. So it would be a two-dimensional scan parameter. And if you do find something, it's one of those all or nothing scenarios where either you find two particles or you don't find anything. So just to give you an idea of the reach of NA62, there are constraints from scattering searches and from peak searches for missing mass, which get relaxed due to the visible decays here. But provided you have no backgrounds, this is the type of level the NA62 can give you of mixing angles of order 10 to minus 10, 10 to minus 11. That's not true around the pi zero mass because of those pi zero Dalitz decays. Okay, I don't have much time left, but I did want to, I'm going to jump the miniboom discussion, which is interesting, so you can ask me about later. But I want to just say a few comments on the G-2. So this is an idea that you're all familiar with. G-2 is currently anomalous with the best theory production predictions we have, which are still not the best we can do. So we can improve upon those. And if they turn out to be consistent over time, this would be a good sign of new physics. And the great thing about this is that it cannot be too heavy. So it would be within reach, whether it be a light or heavy set of new particles. A dark photon explanation for this is excluded in the fully visible limit where I decay to standard model particles, or fully invisible limit where I decay to, let's say, completely invisible dark matter particles. But it is possible to have this contribution at some level to the G-2. And it was recently pointed out that constraints from Babar, which are the ones that really preclude you from explaining the G-2 in the invisible one, that they're coming from single photon searches, which then get relaxed in the case where the Z prime decays semi-visibly. So in the fully invisible case, what you're looking for is just a missing mass bump in this parameter here. So that's just reconstructed from your known set. Yeah.
Are we seeing the same, like the slides before, or like, do you guys see a different slide now?
Yeah, I was going to say, I also see still slide 26.
Oh, don't tell me that. Yeah, that's what I thought. It says sharing is paused.
Yeah, just do it again. It's okay. Let's try. Now we see the whole thing.
Yeah. Okay. My apologies. I'm just going to flash at you the results that you were supposed to have seen. This is the near detector of T2K with the upscattering. These are the limits. And as I said before, precluding any upscattering signatures above 5 centimeters lifetime. These are the K of the Ks that I was interested in. So mu, E plus, E minus. And for an A62, they have no backgrounds for this for displaced vertices. And this was just a sample of parameter space of how well you could do for the 10 minus 10 mixing angles. So then I skipped the G-2 discussion. We are all familiar with the result. Minimal dark photon models are excluded. But we can revisit the invisible constraints and show that for a semi-visible Z prime, if this is decaying to particles that produce visible energy alongside missing energy, this constraint from Babar gets relaxed. So this was pointed out by Gopi some time ago in hope to open up parameter space for explaining the G-2 anomaly. Now, the interesting point here is that Gopi discusses this in the context of inelastic dark matter. So I have two states, psi two and psi one. One decays to the other alongside charged leptons. But if my probability of missing the Z prime, whenever it is produced, is smaller than order 10 to minus 3, so your inefficiency to see the Z prime, if it's smaller than this number, you can explain the G-2 around the GV region. So some similar discussion applies for an A62, which is a fixed target experiment. You produce the dark photon and you hope to see missing energy in the system. However, on top of that missing energy, if the Z prime is decaying semi-visibly, for an A62, this does not relax the constraint a lot, but can help you and relax the constraint a little bit. And the reason is that they're a very inclusive experiment. So all of your additional energy will be on top of your primary electron from the beam. So this doesn't change the constraint by too much, but they also did a separate search looking for semi-visible decays, like this scenario we're interested in, displaced decays in the hadronic calorimeters downstream. So this is a dedicated search for that proposal by Gopi, where you have a semi-visible Z prime, and you can see they don't reach quite yet the G-2 region of interest. We revisited this with our own simulation of the experiment, both in A64 and Babar. We actually showed that for realistic assumptions of the Babar simulation, this is not possible under the inelastic dark matter model. So you can see a remake of that same plot that I showed you before by Gopi. With our new bound from an A64, we have the bound from Babar in blue covering the region of the G-2. And in principle, you could also use the invisible dark photon search for an A64, although this has several caveats related to the shape of the shower, how often they would veto it. So we just show it as a dashed line in this parameter space. Now this merges with our discussion of the heavy neutrinos, because this dark photon in the heavy neutral lepton sector would decay to heavy neutrinos, which behave very similarly to this inelastic dark matter story. And those give you semi-visible signatures that can make this dark photon be vetoed at the bar in NA64. It is very challenging to do so. It is possible to find parameter space where the Z prime is sufficiently visible and sufficiently invisible at the same time, where you could get the G-2 region opened up a little bit. But usually this pushes against the largest dark couplings allowed. So an alpha dark of 0.75 is ludicrously large. It will give you a Landau pole not too far from the GeV scale, so you'd have to worry about that. And it'll also give you a large fraction of S channel production. So instead of producing Z primes in inverse in initial state radiation processes, I'm producing heavy neutrinos directly through the Z prime in S channel. And in this case, my alpha dark is much, much larger than alpha. So in the end, I end up winning in the S channel rate. That gives you lots of displaced vertices and multi-lepton final states. So with that, I conclude this talk. So I just want to emphasize again, there's still a lot of parameter space in these more general dark sector models accompanied by the seesaw mechanism in the MeV to GeV scale. We are extending the reach of experiments to this type of scenario by considering new decaying flight searches, upscattering searches, and meson decays. I didn't get a chance to talk about this, but people have discussed these models also as a solution to the mini-Bloom excess, which we're currently testing with a micro-Bloom experiment. And towards the end, I've also discussed possibility of revisiting the G-2 explanation, even though that is pretty challenging to do. If you have enough generations of these particles, the dark photons look very exotic, giving you several multi-lepton final states alongside missing energy. It is possible to do, but you have to have large couplings, and you will see these things in S-channel production if you search for them. And that's it. Thank you. Yeah, sorry for the technical difficulties. Yeah.
Well, it's PI's fault. So we are all at fault. Yeah, any questions? Yeah, I was actually like wondering about the plot that, well, at the place where the technical difficulty happened on page 46. What happens to the left of what you showed?
So to lighter masses, you mean?
Yeah.
So I'm showing you here the region between 20 and 400 MeV for a good reason. This is a HNL mixed with the muon flavor. So when it gets produced in kaon decays, it gets produced alongside a muon. So if I'm heavier than 400 MeV, kaons cannot decay to this HNL. And these constraints disappear, and you have to rely on D-meson production, which is much more difficult to do. So your constraints are of order 10 minus 4. To the left-hand side, you can see on this plot, what happens is you start producing them in pion decays. Uh-huh. And what that means is that you can go all the way to 30 MeV before doing that. And at that point, it's much more beneficial to search for these things in pion decays than to do decay in flight searches. So it is more efficient to look at pion decays below 30 MeV. If you go below 30 MeV, then it gets very challenging for you to reconcile this model with cosmology because it is too long-lived. Mm-hmm. But also you get other constraints depending on your mixing parameters, whether it be from these things being produced at the sun or produced in radioactive decays, where you could look for kink searches in the electron spectrum of radioactive decays, of beta decays. Mm-hmm. So it's a whole different parameter space, which may be interesting on its own, but it is very severely constrained by other parameters, by other searches.
On your right-hand side plot, like it didn't look like that, right? I guess it's like behind like your labels, but.
Oh yeah, so these constraints here are a little bit hidden on this plot here, but they're still there and they're coming from pi on the k.
Okay, but your new searches are better than those for this model, for example.
For this model, correct.
So how does it work at lower masses?
So at lower masses, eventually you stop producing E plus E minuses. You're even at, let's say, 2 MeV, if I go to that region, a 2 MeV HNL decaying to E plus E minus inside of these experiments looks a lot like a photon. So your backgrounds become more severe and your efficiency to separate these pairs becomes very small. So your searches will fall very rapidly below this value. We did not go to very light masses because we think it's very probable that other things will happen, especially in the cosmological side. So we just truncated at 20 MeV. But this will be your dominant decaying flight mode, all the way up to 1-2 MeV, below which value these heavy neutrinos never decay visibly. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. Well, the reason I ask is because, like, it sounds to me like if you go a little bit lighter, like you can produce these things, like in supernova, and maybe you can produce like E plus E minuses
from supernova. You can produce them in supernova. Yes, that's true. So the first thing you'd have to say inside of the supernova is that once you produce these particles, they interact with neutrinos stronger than through the weak force. So they will be in the trapped regime.
Yes.
But that is not as simple as saying that. You would have to really understand the evolution of the supernova with the addition of these new states.
Yeah.
As they start escaping, their decays to E plus E minus may heat the outer layers.
Yes.
So it could also help you with the explosion as the shockwave propagates out. Yeah. And there's another limit where they propagate out sufficiently further away, decay to E plus E minus, which can then emit X-rays. And those were searched for during supernova 1987A. So you could also place constraints on that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's... Sorry, I can give you a more satisfying answer, but it is really a whole new can of worms.
Yeah, I see.
One interesting possibility is below 20 MeV, if you're at 10 MeV, for example, you can produce these guys in boron 8 decays inside of the sun,
uh-huh.
an endpoint of 16 MeV.
Yeah.
And for regions in this parameter space, I would have to compute, but it is not crazy to imagine that you can make these guys decay sufficiently long that they can transverse solar Earth distance and decay inside of these experiments. This was searched for at Borexino, so they have a constraint in the electron mixing case. And you can see this region here. That's coming exactly from boron 8 production, followed by E plus E minus decay inside of Borexino. So if I start adding new forces, this constraint gets modified, so it will also disappear relatively early because the distance is so large that it's easy to make the HNLs decay sufficiently short that they won't reach one astronomical unit.
Mm-hmm.
The usual way that these constraints scale is this upper bound goes as the square root of the ratio of the two decay rates, standard model over new physics. And the lower bound at the top here scales as the ratio itself linearly. So they move simultaneously until they meet and disappear. And that's the limit where you're just too short-lived.
If there are no more questions, let's thank Mateos again.
Yeah, thanks everyone.